Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
We're basically hitting the button of like mutual self-destruction.
Well, hi everybody. Welcome to Exploring the Adventurer's Guide. I think we're probably going to have the bulk of this be Q&A, right?
Likely so.
Do a little tour. Do we have any fun stories from development? I don't remember. It was like months ago.
So it was months ago. Should we? I'm James Jacobs. I'm the creative director of Pathfinder. Who are you people?
I just wandered in. I'm Jessica Price. I'm the project manager at Paizo.
I'm John Compton. I'm the organized play lead developer, and I did one of the development passes on this book.
Yeah.
That's all we got.
I wrote for this book. I think that's why I'm on this panel.
Mm-hmm.
Someone had to be here. Did you tell good stories?
Sure.
Maybe. Plus you warn us about the gross stuff, like don't drink this sparkling wine.
Well, maybe don't a productive way that we can get started, James. Can you tell us a bit about how this book came to be in the first place?
Yeah. So this book was basically once upon a time last year or a year before. We had this idea for this spaceship game called Starfinder, and you may have heard of it. It was originally going to be just one little, you know, rule book, and then of course we're like, we should do an adventure path. We should do this. We should do that.
No. We weren't. That's not how this happened. So we had finally gotten our product schedule on track. When I started, like, our product lines are on an average of 8 months behind.
So that's what happened.
Yeah, and so like. Over many years, with much blood and much pain and a lot of infernal bargains, we'd gotten to the point where not only were we on time, but we had about 2 months of buffer on most of our product lines. It was great. It's how a company is supposed to run. And then Eric's like, we need a space game. And I was like, okay, if we want to spend that buffer we have and understand then we're going to be back to just shipping stuff by the skin of our teeth, and if anything goes wrong, products may be late. But we can do it. And he's like, cool. So I'm like, we can do a core rulebook. And initially, I think it was going to be like 250 pages. And I was like, I think we can manage that.
He had like this bizarre idea that it was like going to be like horror adventures where it was a skin that we...
Yeah, it was going to be a space skin for Pathfinder, basically. Mm-hmm. So then some months passed, and I got a new copy of the product schedule. And suddenly there was a Starfinder AP. And a big core rulebook and many, many other related products.
We like three-digit numbers that start with four.
Yeah, and so I went back to my apartment and I drank a lot. And then we figured out a way to do it.
Yep. Through magic and infernal bargains and blood and sweat.
There was a lot of demon binding.
Yeah.
But the adventure is
good. That's the book
of the day.
That's
much blood.
Anyway, so we did all that and realized that... people still want to play Pathfinder. We still want to make Pathfinder. We wanted to basically keep doing Pathfinder products. We looked at the rulebook offerings for the line, and we had Bestiary 6, which is a great resource for GMs. And then we got Book of the Damned, which is a great resource for GMs. And they were basically kind of back-to-back on either side of Starfinder. And I think it was Lisa had the very astute, canny observations, like, what are the players going to be interested in? And that's a very good question, because we don't want to go for a year with, you know, nothing for players to be interested in and options for your characters and all of that. And so that was basically the genesis for the Adventurer's Guide, which we knew we wanted to have a lot of content for player characters, but we also wanted to start openly embracing the world of Galarian in our rulebook line, which we'd already sort of done all the way back in...
It's been there since the core rulebook.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people are like, no, there must be an absolute separation between the chocolate and the peanut butter. But it's like, all of our world deities are in the core rulebook.
Yep.
You can't play a cleric without either using our world flavor or adjusting the cleric to use other deities, right? It's been there since the beginning.
And then even as much of in... Occult Adventures, we started talking about Boneyard and a lot of the other stuff we've come up with. So for this book, we really wanted to just admit to ourselves what we kind of have already been doing anyway, and just go full on, develop some Galarian content in the rulebook line, give some new information about all of these organizations, And we started thinking about, well, if we wanted to use organizations as the central hub, as it were, and have these organizations be guides for your adventurers to go out and do things, we realized that a lot of our organizations come into popularity through Adventure Paths or through Pathfinder Society, where people are actually engaged with these organizations, see them actually, in some cases, appear and manifest for the first time and help build them up. And they're basically the groups that people have come to know and love and hate. So that was basically the backbone of the book. And then we wanted it to be filled with pretty much every possible type of character option we could give people, because, you know, that's, characters are being killed all the time. It's a sad but true story. You know, terrible things happen. You open the wrong door, you like fall into a pit, you think you can jump over it, but you can't because you got little meaty legs or whatever.
Piss off the GM.
Yeah, you can do that. So you have to make new characters all the time, and this book will help you with new archetypes, new prestige classes, new spells feats, new shaman options, new something you can finally let your horse wear as a cloak, which we never let you do before, even though the real world lets you do it.
And you can enchant them, just like normal cloaks.
Yeah.
For your horse.
One of the big things I wanted to do is get some more prestige classes in, because I'd seen a lot of people asking for prestige classes. We did a little bit of that with the Pass the Prestige Player Companion a while back, and people seemed to be pretty clued with that. And it's a topic that we haven't really done much with in other role-playing in our RPG line, because it's for two reasons. They don't really fit in with a lot of what we do these days. And the strength of a prestige class, I think, is when it's tied to a specific world. Now, you could do something like a Mystic Theurge, or a lot of the ones they had way back in the D&D days. And they are mostly more about, here's how you play a fighter and a wizard, like the Eldritch Knight. Or here's how you play an arcane trickster. Here's how you play an elf that shoots an elf wizard type ranger with the arcane archer and stuff like that. And those, to me, are really kind of boring. I'm much more interested in, like, here is a prestige class that is all about the culture that rides mastodons through the tundra of the northern regions of the world.
Well, plus, mechanically, we kind of covered a lot of that territory with the advanced class guide, where they're all hybrid classes. Like, at this point, if you want to play, if you want to play something that is combining two classes, you have that.
We even have it through all the archetypes.
Yeah.
So then, it was basically, we had a big brainstorm, like everybody throw up, everybody shout out your favorite organizations. We had the whiteboard covered with like probably 50, 60 organizations. And it was then my job to go through and pick as many as I could fit into a book that Jessica had pointed out. We can do 100 and whatever pages it is, and if we do one extra page,
no more,
there will be blood, and the kind of blood that we don't want to lose. Which basically helped me, which is important, because we don't want to do everything in one book, because we want stuff for other books in the future, of course. But then, once we picked all these out, it was a case of like, we want to cover some stuff that we've done a lot before, so like the Hell Knights, we've already done an entire book, so that material is a fair amount of like reprinted material, but we also want it to mostly be new content, and about two-thirds, most of the book is new material. And so we go to like new things, like you just started doing stuff with the Elsbury in Kadira, so I was like, would you like to write more about horses? I know I had to cut a bunch of words about spices.
I know. It was so, like, in fact, I have already written this for the flesh book they won't let me publish here.
That's the best kind of freelance. Yeah, it's done! And then, of course, going to John, it's like, hey, not only would you like to write and do the Pathfinder size, you seem to have some sort of background associated with that group.
Can't imagine.
Yeah. But also, one thing that I really wanted this to be is as fresh out of the gate appropriate for Pathfinder Society players. And I barely know what a Pathfinder Society is. It's frightening to me. And I have endless...
James is an introvert.
I am, you look it up in the dictionary and it got a picture of me doing this. But at the same point, the Pathfinder Society is so hugely important to everything that Paizo is and does. And so I forget how I managed to convince you or how it all worked out, but we got you to basically do the second pass on this book to make sure it's all It was all legit for a Pathfinder Society.
There are inferno bargains there, too.
Poor decisions. Nightmare fuels. Anyway.
I think part of my doing a second pass was because that's something that I'd been requesting internally, just to be able to have more exposure to the rules before they go to print as opposed to after. Just because it even streamlines a lot of the additional resources process. If I've already done a development pass alongside James on this, then if I were going to have a problem with it before, we've already addressed this.
Yes.
Linda and I've gone through a whole lot of it now, and boy, is a lot of this getting in. It's like
nice.
A couple things from the Aspis Consortium that are like the kick a puppy feet. Or the betray my allies archetype. I mean, those are not in there. Surprise.
Yeah.
But pretty much everything else is getting in with no trouble.
And it's this stuff that even if you don't let the players use, I can imagine betray my allies is a good archetype for the bad guy.
Absolutely.
In a Pathfinder scenario.
Go for it.
I think that kind of brings home like one of the things that I really like about this book is a lot of times our in-world organizations are limited to stuff that the players either have to fight or like go to for help. And there's not a ton of ways for players to get into those organizations and to have that be something player-facing rather than GM-facing. So, you know, I mean, things like you can play the Aspis Consortium in a few special scenarios that are like, and in this one, the shtick is you're in the Aspis Consortium.
But Dribble Lodge!
Dribble Lodge forever! A few years back here at PaizoCon, John convinced cons are hard. We have to be on a lot. So, like, for a lot of us, you know, when it's like when our panels and stuff are done, it's like, and I'm going to my room and I'm drawing myself a bath and reading a book and I'm not interacting with people anymore. So, one of the sad parts about that is we don't get to interact with Pathfinder Society a lot because, you know, by the time it's like the special is going or whatever, most of the employees are like tired or they want to just like socialize with people. But John convinced a bunch of us to play one of the scenarios where you play members of the Aspis Consortium and you have to infiltrate a Pathfinder Society gathering. So we realized that there was no Pathfinder Lodge in Druma. So our party went in and claimed to be from the Pathfinder Lodge in Druma, figuring that nobody would know that there was, you know, they'd just be like, oh, okay, I've never heard of it, but sure, that makes sense.
Anytime anybody questioned them, they would just shout Druma Lodge at the person.
1%!
and shout until the people walked away.
Pretty much.
What's worth it tricked me.
Yeah. Of course there's a Druma Lodge.
Of course there's a Druma Lodge.
There's a lot of money in Druma.
Right.
So, yeah. Opportunity for profit and adventure.
Where do I sign my bank account down?
Exactly. And actually, speaking of joining organizations, one of the neat overarching elements of Adventurer's Guide is the affiliation system. So we've done numerous things in Pathfinder where you can join an organization. Sometimes we have quantified it. For example, the Pathfinder campaign setting Faction Guide has a way of earning prestige points toward your different organizations, and they unlock different benefits. We have the school system that shows up in Intersea Combat, Intersea Magic, Intersea Intrigue that lets you say, okay, I'm going to pay tuition to this school every month and make a check every time and gradually advance, and as I do favors, eventually they'll start paying me, and that'll feel pretty cool. But with the 15 organizations in Adventurer's Guide, there's sort of a desire to make sure that it wasn't just freebie content if you didn't want it to be. So we have the Red Mantis Assassins who aren't well known for sharing their techniques to anybody who wants to be like, hey, can I have some of those Sarcooth Sabers?
Oh, they'll share it with you.
Oh, yeah.
Right through the gut, sure.
Yeah.
And so the affiliation system involves three different levels of how precise or how restrictive do you want your campaign to be in incorporating these materials. So you can be super strict. You can say, if you are not a member of this organization, you can't touch this chapter. And that's fine. That can work for some games. There's the super free one, which is, yeah, this is a book of rules. I mean, if you really want to take this book as setting, or like scrub the setting from it and say, okay, this sure is a thing for stabbing people with two swords at once, that's fine, however you want to run your game. But there's also something in the middle that is the sort of affiliation standard, which is the idea that you can belong to one or more of these groups or be affiliated with them. You might be a member, you might just be a really good friend, and they're like,
well, you might not have joined the Aspects Consortium, but you sure have, like, shot a bunch of the people who get in our way. So, why don't we pass you an Aspis badge and teach you some of the techniques? I go back to the Aspis Consortium a lot these days. You can basically draw upon those resources and those chapters depending upon how charismatic your character is. Basically, how many connections can you maintain at once? So the affiliation standard is you get one affiliation, plus you can have up to one more affiliation per charisma bonus. And then there's a feat in there called extra affiliations, which if you want to spend a feat to gain two more affiliations beyond that, then you can. So if you wanted to play that sort of character who is a Hell Knight who is helping to face down the drow with the Lantern Bearers while also training as a monk in the Houses of Perfection, good lord, why? then you sensibly could. But I think it was a really neat way of creating a variable gateway for GMs to control how much content is allowed in their campaigns and how you're going to use it.
And there's also the idea that you could give out affiliations as treasures and rewards. Like, if you go on an adventure and your characters are working for, the Grey Maidens, and you do good and you bring back their trophy or whatever it is they sent you out, they're like, rather than say, here's your reward, a bag of gold with a dollar sign on the side, they could instead say, you are now affiliated with the Grey Maidens, and that would just be free. You know, it wouldn't matter if you had zero charisma or were unpleasant to be around, because all adventures are charming and wonderful people. And that way, not only would you get that as your bonus, that's a way for GMs to give out things like prestige classes or archetypes or... new sorcerer bloodlines, stuff like that. It's a way to give those out kind of as treasure, which is an interesting way to reward people. One other thing that we wanted to do as well was to take some of these affiliations and groups that we introduced in Adventure Paths and explore what happens to them after the Adventure Paths are done. So it's sort of an experiment in that regard where we've got the Grey Maidens don't exist unless you run Curse of the Crimson Throne, for example. But they exist after. And the Silver Ravens are another group, which is tied close to Hell's Rebels, and the Lantern Barons are tied close into Second Darkness, and there's maybe one or two
Council others. Of Thieves.
Council of Thieves, that's a good example. And by putting these groups in there, we can show how those adventure paths can have effects on the world and how things keep going and makes it more of a living, dynamic world. It allows us also to make some corrections. Like when we came up with the Grey Maidens, first of all, the whole point of the Grey Maidens was we needed stormtroopers for Queen Iliosa to throw against people. That was really all they were intended to be. But then Wes took the ideas that I was originally putting into the outline, and he ran with them, and then we got Eva Witterman to do this picture that was so awesome, we put it on the back of the core rulebook. All of a sudden, Grey Maidens are one of the most iconic, recognizable features of the game, because everybody who buys a core rulebook sees one. But they're bad guys, so... and by extension, not great choices for player characters, but there's ways that in Adventurer's Guide, they've now split into two factions. One has gone south to join Cheliax, and they can stay bad guys. The other side is more interested in kind of redeeming themselves and reclaiming their own powers under their own auspices and everything. Same goes with the Lantern Bearers, where in Second Darkness, we weren't able to pull off elves as being actually good. They were kind of standoffish, which is something that I was frustrated with. And with the Lantern Bearers, we're able to, now that all of the weird corruption and stuff is taken care of in that adventure path, the Lantern Bearers can finally come into their own and be their own group of actually a force for redemption, a force that doesn't go out and kill the bad guys, but goes out and saves the bad guys from themselves and recruits them and helps them to be new things. And in both cases, for example, makes for really compelling player character resources. Again, they're not all good guys. I mean, it's easy to hate Hell Knights and Aspis Consortium people.
But it also gives you a chance to see these organizations from different perspectives, right? Because, like, in the real world, various organizations, like, we don't even really know what the truth about them is, because we're always seeing them from a particular perspective. Like, if you're a member of a particular organization, you're going to think it's good. If you're not, you know, somebody that historically you've had a conflict with, you're going to see them as a bad organization. The truth is probably somewhere in between, but and we get similar things, you know, like in the Adventure Path, something might be antagonists. With the section I did with the Elsa Brady, like, I introduced them in the Kadira book, but Elzabrit is a region, you know, and they are basically just a feature that is in that region. So you're seeing them primarily as like, these are the people that live in this region, and they're kind of secretive, and they don't let people into their holds, and they breed horses. And so creating it as something that players might be members of gives you the chance to be like, and here's why they're secretive. Like, here's what they're trying to protect. And, you know, instead of it focusing on the region, it focuses on them and how they interact with the place that they live. So it's just a nice way to get different different perspectives on groups that may seem familiar until you see it from the inside.
Something more that doing this book in the rules line has done for us, and this is especially important for me doing adventures, is that anytime we do things in the rules line, we're bringing it into the PRD, which it makes it not only more accessible to players and GMs everywhere, but also means that when we're doing adventures, we can reference that directly. And so we can take things, we can take our books that have limited page space, and we can simply reference an online resource that's free to you, and use those saved words to make an even more engaging story. So now when I'm doing Pathfinder Society stories, we can start to...
Go on, continue.
Then I can start to reference the Aspis chapter and say, oh yeah, these Aspis agents have the... or the Order of the Asp Cavalier Order, which is the... Let's be honest, it's the Order of the Asshole Cavalier Order, even more than the Order of the Cockatrice was. So, but I don't have to reprint it all. I can just say, bam, here it is. It's there for you to use. So that's super important for me.
The reason I started grunting like a monkey was one of the things that I've really been excited about is just obviously all this world content. And the Red Mantis is something near and dear to my heart that I've been toying with forever. And when I put them into Galarian, and then they ended up being in the Intersea World Guide, there was a couple of really frustrating typos that crept in. And due to the way that our errata policy is, we only issue errata when we reprint a book, and we're getting better and better at estimating what our print run should be, which means we don't reprint as much, which makes it tricky to issue errata, especially if it's not on the rulebook line, because the rulebook line gets the focus of our errata attention. This is a chance for me to go in and actually get some clarifications in on particularly the Red Mantis Assassin Prestige class, which until Adventurer's Guide suffered arcane spell failure for wearing their signature armor, which was never the intent. They can cast spells like bards if they're wearing light armor, basically, now. So that works as intended. And also, the fact that they have this whole fighting style based around using two swords in a sort of a stylistic, dexterous type agility format meant that they weren't intended to be really strong, beefy characters. They're like little wiry, squirrely able. Then when we put the sawtooth saber into ultimate equipment, the rules for the sawtooth saber change to make it, you know, more balanced for use as an exotic weapon. But as an unintended result for that, suddenly the Red Mantis Assassins, all the Red Mantis Assassins world were really terrible at fighting with their signature weapons. So that was another thing I managed to do. If you take a level in Red Mantis Assassin, you can now use your sabers as fully as if they're light weapons and do like lots of lengths of damage and stuff and stab people the way you're supposed to if you are an assassin. Thank you. That is all. I will resort to my monkey noises later.
Very gracious.
So do we want to do a Q&A?
Yeah, I think that could be pretty good. I just touch upon that for some of these organizations, these were ones where we had provided in-depth rules content for a portion of the organization. But Paizo also has a habit of like name-dropping things or providing little teasers of mysteries that hopefully you as a GM or a player can sort of grab onto and run with and turn into an adventure. But that has left a couple of things where we're like, oh yeah, the Eagle Knights, they sure do have the Grey Corsairs and the Golden Legionnaires. Here are prestige classes for them, and they have the Twilight Talons. Shh, they don't exist. And then we never really gave them rules content again. This has been a chance to expand upon that as well, so that if you want to play the super secret agent for Liberty, then you can.
Alright. Oh, okay.
Who wants to call on questions so we don't have you?
I think your hand was up first.
So with the Hell Knight chapter in particular, it appears that a lot of that content is direct reprints, and particularly looking at how things have changed since the original versions came out. We didn't really see any updates that future-proofed some of these. For example, with the signature, the signifer requiring warrior priest or arcane armor training, war priests still have to take arcane armor training because they don't qualify for warrior priest.
So, first of all, it's not a perfect book. No book is perfect. The fact that it's in the rulebook line gives us a chance to go through and actually errata it as needed and make changes. It's not something we would have been able to do in previous editions of the book. We tried to catch as many of these things as we could. There's also an element, I mean, almost a philosophical element, and this is something that we're going to be talking about with the design team and elsewhere, but war priests are really, really, really good as they stand. And in a case like that, making it so that it's a little bit more difficult for a war priest to get even better at something by taking a class like this, and it's easier for a cleric perhaps to do it, might be not necessarily a bad thing. You know what I mean? I know people that want war priests to be as good as clerics, might want to have that, I guess, fair, but to a certain extent, we don't want to upstage clerics by giving everything that a cleric can do to a war priest or something like that. So that's something that we'll need to be talking about with like the design team and looking over when we get to errata and all that, and also, frankly, looking at the message boards and seeing feedback on it all. So it's something we will be able to take into account, and since it is in the rulebook line, we can issue clarifications as needed. Whereas it's always been a trickier process.
One of the other things in that particular example is that I know that there has been a strong contingent on the message boards also asking for signifers to be psychic compatible. Well, at that point, you're asking for is something that maintains some of the original prerequisites so it doesn't upset previous characters, which means those original two feats have to stay in there. Adding something for psychic spellcasters, adding something in there for war priests, adding something in there for other future proofing, which means eventually we end up with a list of like five or more feat requirements. It's sort of a pick what you want one. And at a certain point, it starts to break down what the prestige class could be used for and might just be more of an invitation for us to explore future Hell Knight options that would address some of those other base classes.
Absolutely. My preference for like the people that are looking for a psychic Hell Knight element. The Hell Knights don't really have much going on with psychic powers, and that's to a certain extent because we did a lot of Hell Knight work before we came up with Occult Adventures. But it's also intentional. They're really more focused on like law and mercenary, like martial stuff and diabolism. But this is absolutely an opportunity for us to, in the future, say, come up with a new order, like the order of, the order of the
crystal,
thought, the order of the third eye, or stuff like that. And we can come up with new types of Hell Knights that are psychic friendly, and that's an opportunity for us, I think, to expand on. So, I mean, certainly let us know on the message boards and all that, but sometimes, I've said this before, sometimes you can define things by what they aren't as much as well as what they are. So if everything can do one thing, it's kind of takes away some of the special niche appeal. That makes sense. I know it's not necessarily the answer that you were looking for, but...
Well, from the perspective, John, in regards to your point about having five different feat options as a prerequisite, isn't that sort of the design philosophy that ended up going with the Westcraft before?
Yeah, not the design philosophy for every prestige class needs to be for every...
Yeah.
Like so some of them are open to that.
For example, the Evangelist from Intersea Gods is a super versatile prestige class because it allows you to continue doing some of the features from your original class. It is designed to be super open. But the Red Mantis Assassin, for example, is built for certain styles of characters, and so there may be the question of, well, why isn't there a Blood Rager Barbarian Red Mantis Assassin prestige class? Or why can my Blood Rager not be fully supported with the Red Mantis Assassin? As James said, it's partly defined by what it isn't. But yeah, I think it's fertile ground for future development. It's just, we wanted to make sure that we had the Hell Knight and the Hell Knight Signifer in full proper working order in a core rulebook going forward.
Ultimately, with character options, you're always going to have some that are Swiss Army knives, and you're going to have some that are precision tools, right? They don't all have to work the same way. And especially, I think, when you get into stuff that is super specific within the world, it's not going to be right for every character. It's not going to do everything.
And when it comes to the 5 feats that I came up with as a hypothetical for all the future-proofing, you know what? If maybe that future-proofing also doesn't fully address the shifter or something like that, and so it could be biting us in the rear yet again when it still doesn't meet those considerations.
We'd like to pretend that us 10 years ago knew everything that us now is doing, but we don't, like, spoiler alert, we don't know what classes we're going to be doing in 5 years, so.
Good question,
remember? Oh, yeah. All right. Who else?
So, getting ready to, getting ready to GM Curse of the Crimson Throne.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in the Adventurer's Guide that maybe didn't make it into the adventure path for the Grey Maidens that I should be super excited about and totally absolutely use? Besides everything.
So, everything. The content for the Grey Maidens in Adventurer's Guide first and foremost assumes that Curse of the Crimson Throne is over and done with. So this is post Crimson Throne's Grey Maidens stuff. There are things like weapons and feats and prestige classes and stuff like that that you could add on to Curse of the Crimson Throne. But I really think that that might be better. I mean, if you're going to, like, thinking, you know, the long game down the road, if you want to do a second a campaign after you're finished with Curse of the Crimson Throne, that second campaign, I think, would be a much better place to bring in the Adventurer Guide Grey Maiden content, as, like, this is an evolution of what happened in the previous campaign. And that gives your players a chance to first experience the Grey Maidens as, you know, they were originally debuted, rather than giving them everything at once. If somebody's never tasted chocolate before, you probably should just give them a piece of chocolate. You shouldn't, like, give them a caramel, pretzel, chocolate, sea salt confection, which is what I had for lunch and it was delicious, but you want to let them taste the chocolate first before you give them, like, drink from the fire hose.
Essentially, it's like, in classical music, a big part of the way a symphony works is elaborating on a theme, but you always lay it out there plainly first, you know, so the audience can learn what the theme is, and then you do all your variations on it.
But as a GM, that's absolutely a thing. You could read that section of the Grey Maidens for more inspiration and background and material about them. And, you know, pick and choose what works for you.
And as far as keeping in mind that some of these organizations are evolutions of what happened in some of these adventure paths, remember that these evolutions take place over time. And so over the course of Curse of the Crimson Throne, you could be illustrating and seeding some of the ideas that later on led to these changes that show up in the Adventurer's Guide, so that by the time you're bringing in those rules in full, the players can point to it and say, oh, hey, we were a part of that.
Yeah.
Or, hey, this character name, because the Adventurer's Guide features 3 major leaders for each organization, you'd have one of those leaders show up earlier in a younger form and be in a sort of an unwilling ally of the PCs at first, who gradually comes to trust them more, and be a window into that change. Make it into a story. That's what these adventures are about.
Thank you. Do you hand up first?
How many organizations from PFS made it into this book, and are any of the retired factions in the Adventurer's Guide, or just the new ones?
So in this case, we're looking at factions less from a Pathfinder Society perspective, because those are sub-organizations within the Pathfinder Society, primarily at least. So this was not about addressing things like Liberty's Edge or Sovereign Court. That's still something that we explore within the organized play campaign, and we tend to create, like, new traits for them and the like. This was instead a look at the Pathfinder Society as a whole, or the Red Mantis Assassins as a whole, things like that.
So for getting to organized play, I know, just to clarify assumption, this event, the tiers for Pathfinder Society max out at 11. So would this be an idea that the transitions to higher level characters may be to another organization or higher level? What's kind of
Let me get some clarification on that one, because I don't quite understand the second part. So once a character hits, like, level 12, then
yes.
they would move beyond the Pathfinder Society into some other group?
Correct.
I think the premise of your question is based on something that is no longer true.
Okay.
Pathfinder Society had what was commonly considered a retirement point once you hit 12th level, because common adventure tiers were like all the ones up through 11, and then we had Eyes of the Ten for just sort of the final little hurrah. But with the sanctioning of modules, with the sanctioning of adventure paths, and last year with the introduction of a new secret arc called All for Immortality, there's been increasing amounts of higher level content that allows players to take their characters all the way to 20. It's been mapped out that way. Granted, most of what you'd be doing isn't scenarios in particular, but rather other Pathfinder content. So we've been increasingly looking at our additional resources usage from the perspective that although standard play may sort of peter off after 11th level, there's still plenty of opportunity for higher level play.
Okay.
It's more meta question, I guess, which is previously there'd be a lot of a hardback called X would come out, followed a few months later by Inner CX. With this really kind of starting to really integrate those things together, is that trend going to continue?
We actually, this is brand new, so I don't think we've really.
It depends on the book. I think you're probably going to see a campaign setting related to Ultimate Wilderness, because it is more of a traditional Ultimate. Like, we have sublines within each line. You know, if you notice, we have Blood of in the player companions, and that's sort of a sub-brand within it. And in the hardcovers, we have, you know, X Adventures, and we have Ultimate X. So, you know, with books that follow that sort of pattern, you probably are going to continue to see a campaign setting that's related to it, maybe even a player companion. For Adventurer's Guide, because it has a lot of campaign setting material in it, probably not. More likely, you may see adventure or organizations from the Adventurer's Guide showing up more in campaign settings.
Or new organizations, like we might do one for, there's all sorts of groups that we haven't done. Like, we didn't do anything for the Free Captains of the Shackles. We might do a group for that book. But really, on a certain level, books like Advanced Class Origins and Mythic Origins and all those existed to contextualize the rulebook in Galarian in and of itself, which is, it was sort of a bridge, or as almost even a band-aid or something like that. Going forward, if that content, rather than being in a 32 or a 64 page book or whatever, was just part of the hardcover, it's already in one spot. You don't have to keep track of two spots to get all that stuff. And that opens up one of those 64 page slots for us to do something more specific, or rather than do, for example, Mythic, or rather than do, for example, something like a Horror Realms, maybe we would have done a 64-page book all about Nadal instead. Yeah.
So, I mean, this is not to, like, those books are great. This is not to denigrate those books, but they tend not to be the passion projects of anybody on staff. It tends to be kind of like, okay, we need to do a book that contextualizes this for Galarian. We will divide it up between a bunch of different authors. And, you know, they are so templated that there's not always a lot of room for a ton of creativity or experimentation. I think what you may see is if we decide that the format for the organizations in the Adventurer's Guide is good, you know, if we decide that that's a good format that works out well, it's cool to have a prestige class and a couple archetypes, and you may see sections of the campaign setting that are essentially that format for, like, okay, now we're going to do a new organization. You can see it a little bit with when we do, like, new deities and stuff. Sometimes we use the format from Inner Sea Gods, where we have the three Evangelist, Sentinel, and
Exalted.
Thank you. Exalted boons and stuff like that. So when we find a format we like, then we start to import that into other things.
And speaking just briefly on the passion project thing, I think part of what helped shape some of the organizations that went into this was that several of them are passion projects. Yeah. So, like, again, hey, Jessica, do you want to write about horses? Or
also Chris, the spice route.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, that's what you mentioned, that these, like, advanced class options isn't a passion project. What we mean by passion project would be something like somebody on staff either wants to write it or wants to basically do the outline and assign a freelancer to write it and develop it and all that. And in every case, I think, that results in a better book. The one that comes to mind just because you're sitting there and I'm looking at you is the Kadira book, which is a book that we could have done by just hiring 7 or 8 different people to write different sections about Kadira, but Jessica has feelings about Kadira.
I have feelings.
And so we basically, I think that was actually the case, I've already written it, here it is.
It is, by the way, also in our store, and if you buy a copy, I'll even sign it for you in pretty gold pen.
So it's just a better way to do books because it makes the writers happy, it makes the customers happy because it's...
Well, and it makes sure that all the parts of the books talk to each other.
Yeah.
Like, and this is... no faults of anybody involved with this book. It was dictated primarily by the schedule. But, like, I was super interested in Andoran, and then the Andoran book ended up being a little bit rushed, and we had to, like, assign it out to a bunch of people, and they all had fairly short timelines to write it. So, like, they didn't get a chance to, like, talk to each other that much. So you have a bunch of sections in the Andoran book, all of which internally make sense to that section. But there's not a sense when you read about a region, if you look at the history chapter, there's not a sense that, like, that region was shaped by these events in history. Versus when you have a single author or you have people that a particular developer at Paizo has picked, not because that freelancer is available, but because they know that this particular person has subject matter expertise or is really passionate about the subject, you get a book that is much more holistic. I think you had your hand up first, and we'll go back this way.
So, with the amount of organizations that you come up with in terms of content for this book, do we have an idea of when Adventurer's Guide 2 will be coming out? I know that's the question you hate, right?
I really don't like putting twos after numbers unless the number that came the word that came before that is bestiary. But obviously, there are more organizations than the 16 in this book, and it could be we now that we have a format for this. I mean, we could do something in the future, just like techno-abolitionists guidebook, and it's all about people that hate technology and want to destroy technology, and about people that embrace technology and all that. And that whole section could be like maybe 40 pages of new technological items, and then maybe a 12-page section for the Technically in this format that we've done this book. I think more likely what you'll see us maybe do is if Adventure, I mean, it just came out. We don't know if people love it or hate it or whatever. We're still getting all that data in. But it's certainly a 64-page book in the softcover line that talks about, like, a faction, not faction, but, like, organization, Adventurer's Guide to Western Borussia. And we do 6 groups. Like, we do the Skarni, and we do, like, the Mystery Cults of Magnemar, and we do the Free Captains of Brittleport. We could do something like that for sure. And if people are really interested, it's a great way to set up a bunch of new player options, I think.
Essentially, one of the things that, you know, helped Paizo evolve into the company that it is now, our subscriptions, also mean that there's a delay in us figuring out how well a particular book sells. Because, like, the first people that are going to get it are subscribers, and they're going to get it regardless, right? So it's, we need to wait for a little bit to see, like, well, who else buys it? You know, I mean, retailers and stuff, but that's fairly consistent too. So with something like the Adventurer's Guide, I think we're not going to know whether we want to do a second one, even if we call it something else, if it's, you know, structured slightly different, until we've had a chance to see, like, how do these options play in PFS? Do people like them in PFS? How does this book sell once everybody who was going to get it, regardless of what it was, you know, has gotten it and other people have had a chance? How much errata do we have to do for this? You know, how much do our freelancers like this book? Like, are they trying to incorporate stuff that we've done in this hardcover into the assignments that we give them? Do they like it? You know, so it's going to be a while till we know.
It's also, it might go a different direction as well. Like, we've done this book, Path of the Hellknight, which is 64 pages about Hellknight materials. That's a lot of great stuff. And that is a great example of a passion project. Mm-hmm. Wes Schneider wrote that whole thing because he is a kind of sort of the Hellknight. But then when we did Adventurer's Guide, in the first draft of the Adventurer's Guide, there were no Hellknights in that book because we're like, we've already done Hellknights and we can't really do much justice to them. We've already done them in 64 pages. And I brought that up to Wes, and he's like, what do you think of that? He's like, if we do this book and there's no Hell Knights in it, that'll look like we've made a mistake. And he's right. So we put the Hell Knights into this book, and there's, like you were mentioning, there's a fair amount of reprinted material. That's why there's a lot of stuff in there. But I could see us going the other direction for the other 15 groups of the thing. I would love to do, for example, a 64-page Path of the Red Mantis book.
And the cover of Adventurer's Guide even tells a part of that same story, yeah, because it shows the Grey Maidens, the Hell Knight, and the Red Mantis Assassins on the cover, in part because those who were purchasing the RPG line to begin with might not be familiar with our setting, and this can be an opportunity to sort of introduce them to a lot of the touchstones of our setting that have really guided a lot of our development ever since.
Yeah. Isabel, I don't know if I can actually answer this at this time, but one of the things I was really sort of interested in and sort of struck by when I first got my copy and looked it over was the affiliation system you talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. I was curious if you were planning to implement that for PFS specifically, like your PFS character must choose affiliations and you can get them on Pronto, stuff like that.
Linda and I have done a good deal of discussion with this, along with, we have a really great group of volunteers in the VO Corps that help us review all the content. And so in discussions with them, we've gone over which version of affiliation we want to use, and right now we're leaning toward a more permissive one. Okay. But we'll see once the final additional research come out. Got about 3 minutes left, so if we want to hit one more question.
Yeah.
What are all of the factions in the guide?
Oh my god.
Got it right here.
Oh, you do? I was going to try to do it out from memory.
Oh, please do.
I can't do it. I'll try. Alzebrite.
Yep.
Aspis Consortium.
You missed one.
And no, I'm not going alphabetically. Okay. Bellflower Network.
Yeah.
Pathfinder Society. Red Mantis. Houses of Perfection. Silver Ravens, Storm Wardens, Lantern Bearers, Rivethune, Eagle Knights, and
ready for some help?
No, the Mammoth Lords, and that's 12.
Yeah.
I need four more.
You need three more.
Three more. I want. Oh yeah! Oh, the Dalidori Swordlord. Thank you.
Let's see. How else do I want to pantomime some of these?
This is how we amuse ourselves.
Oh, I don't know what that means.
Oh, why did you take my tea?
I'm stealing things.
Oh yeah, Council of Thieves, duh. Grey Maidens, and Hellites.
Sounds about right.
Really impressive, James. Well
done. Yeah, that means that I didn't waste 9 months. But there's also a lot of other ones that I really wanted to put in here that we didn't have room for. So I think that's when I was speaking to the possibility of new books like this, because there's like the Skarni were at one point a group in there. Pretty much every religion could be one of these things.
Yep.
Pure Legion could be one. I would love to do the Pure Legion. I don't want to do it in a player-facing book because I would go to my grave with the raising the flag that the Pure Legion are bad guys that you should fight against.
Speaking of that, the Whispering Way is one I would love to see.
Whispering Way would be good. The Whispering Way is a great example for something like, that's on par with, I think, like the Hell Knights. That is an organization that we could do not only just a 64-page book on. I could see us do something that whole book size just on the Whispering Way, because that is such a core part of the world. So. But yeah, Whispering Way is a great example.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming.
Yep.
And yeah, thank you for being here.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.